from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. A 19-year-old former student has been charged with 17 counts of premeditated murder, suspected of killing 17 adults and children yesterday at Marjorie Stoneham Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. Florida Governor Rick Scott spoke about what needs to be done to protect kids at a press conference this morning.
If somebody's mentally ill, they should not have access to a gun. All of us have children, or grandchildren, nieces or nephews. None of us want this, anything like this to happen.
We'll get the latest on yet another mass school shooting. And then at 9:30, we discuss how the Bay Area fits into the Trump administration transportation plan that was announced earlier this week. It's all coming up. Stay with us. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. 19-year-old Nicholas Cruz is charged with 17 counts of premeditated murder in Broward County, Florida, suspected of killing at least 17 people yesterday in a terrifying rampage at his former high school. The youth was armed with an AR-15 rifle and smoke grenades and reportedly tripped the school's fire alarm to lure students into the hallways. He had been expelled from the Marjorie Stoneham Douglas High School in Parkland for disciplinary reasons. We're going to discuss the latest developments in this latest tragic school shooting with Mark Fullman, who's here with us in studio. He's National Affairs Editor for Mother Jones Magazine. Mark, grim, and that's all I can say. Like many of the listeners, sad, angry, and frustrated by all this, particularly in light of the fact that another American community in shock and horror and traumatized children, traumatized by the slaying of children, and also feeling what can be done. Congress is simply sitting and doing nothing.
Yeah, I feel like I'm back here too often talking to you about this subject, Michael. You know, we're seeing all of the same debates that we see every time this happens about gun laws and, you know, people want to know why this happens and how it happens. There's obviously a very basic common denominator here, the availability of firearms like this to virtually anyone. Florida, as we know, has some of the laxest gun laws in the country. So, you know, this is an issue that's going to keep returning so long as we don't see a real serious effort on social and legal policy to deal with it.
This is a tactical weapon, again, that we're talking about here. And as you say, it's easily accessible, or we keep hearing about at least doing something about that. There was something done during the Clinton administration, of course, and then it was revoked by 2003.
Yeah, and I think it's important to acknowledge that gun regulations alone won't solve this problem. There was a so-called assault rifle, assault weapons ban during the Clinton administration that lasted for 10 years. It's not clear really what effect that had ultimately on this issue. But that being said, yes, I think it gets lost in the political, the very heated political debate about firearms, that these weapons, these AR-15s and the like, these military-style semi-automatic rifles, they were made for war. I mean, that's why and how these weapons were designed, and to dismiss that is just silly. I mean, you can see it and hear it now more than ever in the videos that we're seeing come out of these attacks. When you hear the firing of those rounds, I mean, if you look at Las Vegas, what happened there, that's the sound of war.
There's enough blame and culpability going around, and people are, you know, looking for those to blame and where to point the fingers. But the reality is that what happened in Florida happened with a young man who was essentially called a threat, put things out on video that were, playing with guns and saying, I'm going to be a school shooter, and the FBI had been warned about him. Lots of things went wrong here that didn't have to go wrong. There could have been intervention, and there could have been something done. I mean, for example, there's a Baker Law where you can take anybody and put them in 72 hours and hold them with psychiatric examination in Florida. It's here. We'll talk about Phil Ting about it in California as well in the course of this segment. But things simply weren't done. People weren't acting in ways that they should have or could have acted. The school didn't necessarily report. They said this kid is a threat, but they didn't report this to law enforcement. And so we have things falling through the cracks again like crazy.
That's right. I think, you know, it's we have to be careful with blame. It's we're still in the early going with learning about how this all transpired. And, you know, with a number of mass shooting cases, you have to be careful with hindsight bias. It's kind of easier to look back and see the warning signs. But I have to say, in this case, with what we've already seen in less than 24 hours, I mean, this was a textbook case of you know, a whole range of behavioral warning signs that are seen in a lot of mass shooting cases and in school shooting cases.
The kid put on social media, "I want to be a school shooter." They had 200 followers.
Right. And not just the social media posts, which, you know, conceivably weren't seen by many people. We don't know that yet. Apparently, some people did see them. I think I saw a story this morning that someone saw a YouTube comment he made and reported it to the FBI. That alone may not be sufficient. But look, this is a kid who was also bringing guns and knives to school. Was reportedly engaging in stalking behavior, had an apparent obsession with firearms, had reportedly been killing animals. These are all behaviors, very disturbing behaviors that people around him were noticing. These are the kinds of behaviors we've seen in a number of mass shooting and school shooting cases in the past.
Mark Fullman is here with us. He's national affairs editor for Mother Jones Magazine and has been doing yeoman work with respect to following gun violence. Beam Furr is county commissioner and mayor of Broward County, Florida. He's a former teacher in the district, and he spoke with NPR this morning. Let's hear what he had to say.
He had been a client at some mental health facilities. But then, you know, we're hearing that his mom had died. And, you know, it's one of those ones where, we missed the signs. We should have seen some of those signs, I think.
That pretty much dovetails with what we've been saying here, Mark, unfortunately, yep. and tragically enough. But you've written also about something that I think needs to be brought into the spotlight here, and that is how often the media really sensationalizes these kinds of things and maybe even leads to some people trying to outscore each other in the number of deaths that they can bring about. It's like a competition almost, you know, get the higher number, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and this is a difficult and challenging problem, Michael. The media coverage, there is significant evidence that we have now showing that people who commit these attacks are aware of how the media handles coverage of previous shooters. And there are many cases where we see evidence of attackers emulating this. And so that presents a real problem for the media because obviously this is a very highly newsworthy topic, and it's very much in the public interest for us to report on this and to understand it in depth. But that being said, there are ways in which the media does tend to sensationalize it, whether it's with posting images taken from the social media accounts of these attackers. We've already seen that in this case. Less than 24 hours in, there was a photo circulating in a New York Times story last night that I was tweeting about where the suspected attacker had posed in this kind of tough guy, cool pose with a handgun. That is exactly the type of image that these people want to have publicized. And I think it really raises an important question. Should the media be doing that, spreading it far and wide? We have evidence of people who look at these images and want to be that. And I think that we can still illuminate this problem without necessarily spreading that kind of material. The same goes with focusing so much on the body counts. I wrote about this recently after Las Vegas and the Texas church massacre. We are seeing mass shootings become more deadly, and that's a serious data point, and that's an issue that we need to report on and discuss. But the emphasis on that in the media, in headlines, and in this kind of scorekeeping mentality that we're seeing is problematic because we know of a number of cases. I've studied many cases of so-called copycats where they explicitly signal or state that they want to outdo the body counts of previous attackers.
And they're influenced by the coverage of these mass shootings. There's very little doubt about that. You, in fact, talked at length with a school shooting expert, a psychologist named Peter Langman, and he pretty much reiterated this or corroborated it, I should say. And I also found in reading an article you did, Adam Lanza, and there was supposed to be action after that. That was so shocking and horrible. I'm talking, of course, about Sandy Hook, that there was the thought that Congress will finally act, and of course it didn't. But I recall in reading an article you did where he was doing spreadsheets, you know, essentially kind of keeping score of how many had been killed in different things, going all the way back to Columbine.
Right. So we know this from what eventually came out in some of the FBI investigation of Sandy Hook, that Adam Lanza had amassed a large amount of information on previous attacks. And that's kind of emblematic of this issue. And we do see this in so many different cases going back, whether it's, specific statements of admiration. There's a whole set of data on this that I've built on just the Columbine attack, which has developed this kind of almost mythological cult following. And again, I think that speaks to the media issue. Whenever we're writing about and talking about school shootings again, you see a lot of references to Columbine, and you see those images circulate again. And we know that attackers aspire to that. They talk about it. They still talk about it. You know, I follow this through a Google alert, and I get cases usually multiple times a week, threats and plots and sometimes attacks, where the perpetrators are citing Columbine as an inspiration. So this tells us something important about the way that the media continues to kind of perpetuate this feedback loop.
It's also really troubling when you think about how inured the public gets when this just keeps repeating itself and going on the news until we get to the next one. We're talking again with Mark Fullman, who's here with us in studio, national affairs editor for Mother Jones Magazine. And this is the 18th school shooting this year. You may indeed want to weigh in, and I invite you to do that now. Our toll-free number is available to you. Let me give it. It's 866-733-6786. If you have thoughts that you want to share with us or some concerns that you want to express, by all means, give us a call now. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. Or go to our website and post your concerns or questions and comments there at kqed.org/forum and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Before I bring Phil Ting into this, which I want to do momentarily, Mark, could you say something about just generally violence restraining orders in California and how this applies? I mean, right now it's mainly immediate family that can actually set things in motion, right?
Right. So this was a policy developed in recent years. The legislation in California, I believe, is the first of this kind. It was, and if I'm correct, it was went into effect last year. The gun violence restraining order allows a concerned family, if they're worried that someone in their family is possibly considering or planning to go on an attack like this, they can petition a court to take away firearms from that person.
And put them under psychiatric hold?
I'm not totally clear on what the parameters of that are, but yes, I think there's a process for dealing with mental health side of the problem as well, if that's present in that case. But the point of the law is to try to remove the immediate danger of someone possessing a firearm where there's concerns that person could go on a violent attack.
Well, we have Phil Ting, and I want to bring him into this. He's state assembly member. He supported and sponsored 2016 bill, which would have expanded California's gun violence restraining order rules to allow school employees to file restraining orders against students and former students, and the bill was vetoed by Governor Brown. Assemblyman Ting, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael, for having me. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Let's talk about where this is now. I mean, you're going ahead with this again, are you not?
Well, we're taking a look at it, obviously, given the recent shooting. The reason the governor vetoed it is the gun violence restraining order had just gone into effect in 2016, which is when we ran the bill. And at that point, people had just started using the gun violence restraining orders. Obviously, this is something that could have been helpful in Florida, because if our bill had passed, people who went to school with this student, people who were teachers or around this student, could have reported him to the court and asked him to have his gun taken away. The gun violence restraining order was also used by a judge in the Rancho Tehama shooting a few months ago in November, where Kevin Neal was told to give up his guns. He gave up the licensed firearm that was on record, but he had purchased numerous kits illegally and assembled guns that were unlicensed, which is what he actually used for those shootings, unfortunately, in Rancho Tehama. But it does demonstrate that the restraining order can be used and can be used to take away guns from, unstable, mentally ill individuals.
So my understanding is that your bill would allow for seizure of weapons by dint of fellow workers or teachers or mental health workers, for that matter, fellow employees. I mean, in other words, we're expanding the number of people who can bring this forward.
That's right. It was really inspired after the San Bernardino shooting, where we had started to see more workplace shootings. Obviously, we unfortunately had that tragedy here at the UPS center here in San Francisco, very close to your offices, where, again, coworkers who would have seen signs of any instability could have asked or requested a gun violence restraining order from court. So we did want to expand because, again, right now many people, especially as you're an adult, don't live with family members or aren't around family. So we wanted to make sure that people who are actually interfacing with these individuals on a daily basis could have the ability to get those guns taken away.
And my understanding also, Assemblyman Ting, is this has passed through the Assembly and now just simply needs to go through the Senate to become law?
No. Right now we are starting an entirely new session. So the bill we got passed through the legislature to the governor. The governor vetoed it in 2016. We did not reintroduce it last year based on his veto message because we wanted a little more time to see how many gun violence restraining orders were actually being used. So we are going to take a look at whether to reintroduce it this year as well, just given the recent incidents.
Well, we'll try to keep up with that, the future of that legislation. And Phil Ting, I appreciate very much your being with us on Forum this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
That's Assemblymember Phil Ting, who represents California's 19th District, which encompasses parts of San Francisco and San Mateo counties. And let me get our callers on here. And let's begin with a caller from Palo Alto. James, join us. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I wanted to ask a question regarding the gun show loophole and private licensed dealers. I'm a transplant from Missouri. And one of the things that I've always felt and noticed is that the licensed dealers equally hate the private gun show loophole and feel that it is one of the critical causes to the gun access problem. And I was wondering, how can we incentivize the licensed gun dealers to get into this conversation regarding gun legislation?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, James. Mark Fulman, what about the gun dealers, the gun shows, and so forth? I mean, how do they play into all this as you see it?
You know, that's an interesting question about whether or not licensed gun sellers would become more vocal advocates for tighter regulation of gun sales. I don't know that I've ever seen that. But, you know, it's interesting. It's almost a misnomer at this point to talk about the gun show loophole because so many gun sales are done through the internet now as well. And it really what it speaks to is that there's a very large number of firearms. We don't know exactly how many that are sold this way, that are sold privately, arranged through internet meetings, arranged at, or done at trade shows. So, you know, there are estimates that go as high as 40% of all gun sales, and we're talking about hundreds of thousands of weapons, if not more. So it's obviously a central issue to regulation of firearm sales.
Let me thank the caller. I'll go to more calls in just a moment. But how do you see the NRA in all this? I mean, there's certainly a great deal of finger pointing at Wayne LaPierre and the NRA and the role that they play in terms of gun violence and not doing things to curb it. How do you see it?
It's, you know, it's status quo. It's an extremely hardened, polarized political dynamic, and the NRA for many years now has used a scorched earth approach to this. They essentially oppose virtually any kind of regulation on firearms. We've seen them pay a little bit of lip service to the issue of domestic violence in recent years, but then kind of quietly work on the side to water down state law efforts to take guns away from domestic abusers. So, you know, really that dynamic is the same as it ever was and suggests that there's very little opportunity for middle ground compromise on this issue, despite the fact that the overwhelming majority of the public supports a number of these measures.
It's about 60% and running, isn't it now, in terms of supporting some kind of gun legislation?
Perhaps overall, I know that, you know, polls have consistently shown in terms of so-called universal background checks, the percentage is much higher.
Much higher for that, yeah. Let me bring some more callers in, and let's go next to Dan. Dan, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for covering this. Yesterday on Marketplace, Kai Ryssdal started out his coverage by saying that there is no marketplace angle to this tragedy, and I'm wondering what you all think about that. And also, what do tragedies like this do to the marketplace? And then finally, what can be done about it?
I didn't hear Kai, but it has a lot to do with the marketplace. I mean, gun profiteering, gun sales are big business.
Yeah, I did hear that actually yesterday and noted it. I think, you know, in Kai's defense, I think he was essentially trying to say, look, we want to acknowledge that this happened. This isn't really what they do on Marketplace, but he wanted to acknowledge it at the top of the show in the way that he said that. But absolutely, there's a large Marketplace issue here. In fact, at Mother Jones, a couple years ago, we did a major investigation into the gun industry. It's an at least $8 billion a year industry, and we essentially profiled 10 of the largest gun sellers who do business in the United States, and they tend to stay very much out of public view. And I think if, you know, one of the ways in which we started to think about this as we looked deeper into it is if you think back on the tobacco industry, you know, going back to several decades, similar approach where they were using lobbying allies to kind of stem any tide of regulation to stop their business and to hold them liable in any way for their product, and at the same time stayed very much out of public view. And it was only when public attention was turned on the tobacco companies themselves that we started to see real change. And there may be an interesting analogy here. I think very few Americans really know much about the gun companies that sell millions of weapons in our country every year.
Well, we're going to have Max Boot with us at 10 o'clock, a military historian, and he's written about semi-automatic military-style weapons being banned in Australia. And in fact, there were about 650,000 that were bought back. They had a number of mass shootings and is a cause and effect? I don't know. They haven't had in years, though, since they did all that buyback and outlawed semi-assault weapons. Let me bring some more callers on. Let me thank Dan for his call and go next to Washington State and welcome Jim as our next caller. Jim, hi.
Hi. I just want to make a statement. My son goes to public school, and every time I hear about these shootings, I am angry. I'm angry because I feel like the politicians and these gun companies feel like that these children are an acceptable loss as long as the money keeps rolling in and as long as they're able to continue their agenda. I'm a truck driver now. Before I drove truck, I was a paramedic in Las Vegas for 8 years. Drive-by shootings, suicide, children shooting themselves with mom and dad's gun. As long as we live in a country where there are four guns for every person, nothing's going to change. And as long, God forbid, something like this happened at one of the private schools where these politicians' children go, who are protected by security, maybe they would do something. But they don't have the collective moral will to stand up and say enough is enough.
Jim, very strong statement from you. Thank you for your call. Appreciate hearing from you. Let me read some comments that are coming in. Mike says nothing will change unless people say no more. It's way better to err on the side of caution. Right now, the situation is hopeless. Another listener writes, the slaughter of innocent young American children and all of these mass shootings in schools is totally unacceptable and represents a total failure by all of those in power to protect our children. And another listener says, it's obvious the perpetrator had mental health issues. Rather than being expelled, he should have received mental health treatment. Mental health has to play a part in this discussion. And Jake says, owning a gun should require regular psychological checkups, the same way I have to undergo periodic eye tests to keep my driver's license. And finally, a tweet from a listener says, let us not despair. My high school sophomore daughter has been moved to activism as a result of yesterday's event. Good note to end on. Mark, thank you. Hope I don't see you for a while, at least not on this kind of tragedy.
Likewise, Michael. Thanks for having
appreciate
me.
Your coming in, though. Mark Fullman, again, is National Affairs Editor for Mother Jones Magazine. And we are going to have another segment. We're going to talk about infrastructure and how the Bay Area fits into the president's infrastructure plan. And beyond that, what this infrastructure means, it seems to be focusing to a much greater degree on rural areas rather than metropolitan areas. Stay tuned for that. It's up ahead. I'm Michael Krasny.